its puppet masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close-chested view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zayas.
Well.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
All right, people, it's no secret that the cubicle-clad cog in the machine Rothschild Rockefeller reality is not a path that comes highly recommended from me, but there can be a sense of comfort to the explorer that eventually it will be there when we're ready to retract back to that all-too-familiar conventional roadmap with the white picket fence. But if you dig into the data, you'll see that that roadmap offered to our parents' generation is now a recipe for ruin as we enter a new economic reality that's as radically different as the Industrial Revolution. These are troubled times, folks. Dare I say, chaotic. And so what better guide than the captain of the Chaos Quidditch team conjured up from sunny West London, the maestro behind the magical symphony that is RuneSoup.com, and the author of not only the previously covered Starships, but now a success magic guidebook for the modern sorcerer, The Chaos Protocols, magical techniques for navigating the new economic reality. My friend and yours, Gordon White, my good man, welcome back to the Higher Side.
Thank you so much, Greg. I was very much looking forward to that introduction. They're always amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've been on so many times now, I'm just running out of creative ways to say you're awesome.
Well, you could put me back in one of the songs, you know, just pointing that out.
Yeah, I'm totally willing to do that. Yeah, man, I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I definitely enjoyed Starships, and I had some very valuable takeaways that are really insightful for getting a more accurate bead on our magical history. But The Chaos Protocols is a success magic book for largely unsuccessful times, and I think it's just what the people need. I loved it, and I think it's very pertinent for the listeners. And to get us started, you know, for us to even know that we need a radically different game plan, we have to realize the radically different shape of the economic game we're playing. Help us to see the situation more clearly. How do we know this isn't just our typical ebb and flow situation? What's really the difference this time?
Well, I guess to start with the good news, the difference is today we have better access to data and analytics than we've sort of ever had before. So it becomes quite easy to like genuinely check whether we are doing better, whether the claims that are kind of being made from sort of government and banking and general economic levels actually matches our lived reality and actually even matches the numbers. Because the reality is they don't. Some of the biggest changes that are occurring, particularly in the West at the moment, are driven by forces that are never going to unwind. So yes, we're in a kind of economic patchy area, but that maybe only covers about 20% of what we're experiencing. The other 80% is quite structural. So we have, for instance, the giant demographic move, which is the baby boomers leaving the workforce. They're not just leaving the workforce, they're actually leaving, shall we say, the consumer force. So the U.S. economy is 70% based on consumption, and retirees don't consume anything. And these numbers are sort of unprecedented. Sort of 10,000 boomers are going to retire every single day between now and 2025. So it is a huge departure out of not only the workforce, but it sucks a whole tremendous amount of demand out of a consumer economy, which obviously has impacts for businesses that are trading in it, and the majority of them are. That is something that isn't going to change. And we've actually kind of reached that tipping point where I think it was officially as of last month, there are more millennials in the workforce than boomers. So we're at the other end of that curve.
Yeah.
The other one, of course, is automation, and this is kind of a huge trend. What we've sort of witnessed, thanks to trade agreements and the rise of China as the world's factory, is an improvement in automation that has automated away over the last 30 years the kind of working class half of the job spectrum. Now it's coming for, and it's sort of sitting in that middle spot, now it's coming for the other half of the spectrum, sort of middle class and up. And we're experiencing on a day-to-day basis with the amount of sort of fast food workers that are being replaced by robots, even as they ask for a rise in minimum wages, which would be nice, but that just triggers the rise of the robots faster. And there's really no there's no turning that off either, because the economics for a business are inarguable in favor of robots. Robots don't get sick. Robots don't need healthcare contributions. Robots don't need to go to their kids' plays. So we're having sort of structural changes that basically mean that the promise of the previous generations of work hard in school. Oh, that's the other one, of course. Since 1980, tertiary education has increased by 9,700%. It's the fastest piece of inflation of anything sort of ever in the West.
Wow.
So we're getting further and further in debt for jobs that aren't there now and won't be there in the future. 75% of Australians in tertiary education are training for jobs that won't be around in 5 years' time.
God.
We're kind of right there. And this whole sort of thing has been, so there is a, shall we say, a disconnect between the narrative that we're being told and the lived reality. And the narrative that we've previously been told is, you know, go to school, work hard, get a job, buy a house, the end, end up in a box. Now, all of these pieces have been fundamentally changed to the point where, to my mind, this sort of what might initially appear to be a radical solution isn't so radical given the alternative. Like the normal one, 100% doesn't work. So where is the sort of insanity in deciding that actually we need to fundamentally rethink how we create money and how we create meaning and what that looks like, rather than trying to sort of LARP a baby boomer life in 2016?
Right, right. You look at the data and it's just obvious that radical change is the only answer. And this mantra of what worked for the baby boomers won't work for millennials is one of the main themes of the book that keeps coming back. And to quote you on it, you say, the baby boomers were the economic equivalent of a biblical locust swarm. And I like that, but it really is a perfect analogy the more you get into it. And maybe you can elaborate on some more of the deeper truths that are in that analogy. It helps to strengthen the point that things really aren't going back.
Well, in other places in the book, there's a bit of license to it, but not much. The story of the American economy over the last 50 years has been the story of things baby boomers buy. So from birth, there was a diaper boom. Then, you know, they kind of got to move through free education into a workforce of 100% employment, because after the war, America represented 70% of the planet's GDP, because Europe was in ruins. Well, Europe and America's enemy were in ruins. So there were jobs for people who had, you know, degrees, and there was housing, because housing was about 20% of GDP. So it all kind of hummed and worked together. You had people employed in stable jobs and growing businesses. And so you could have a building boom that hadn't really been inflated yet. So you could get a house for $11,000 that was a few miles from your factory in Detroit. And that one salary could raise a couple of kids and keep a wife. None of that exists. And if you look at where the baby boomers went after that, in an effort, because there's such a large demographic cohort, what happened was the story of kind of campaign promises is, again, the story of the things that baby boomers want. So they move through free education, and then all of a sudden we have to pay for it because, you know, the baby boomers need a tax cut.
Yeah, yeah.
So everywhere they go, they're kind of pulling the ladder up after them, and then turn around and call the millennials feckless for not having a job or getting out of their parents' basement. It's a betrayal. There's no
right.
other way to describe it. They move through this entire thing buying large cars and then having sort of tax incentives to buy additional houses, which has extra demand at the sort of lower end of the market, which is where first time buyers should be. And all of this happened kind of from the end of Bretton Woods in the late 70s, which is when the kind of market financialized and debt and interest rates shot to the moon. And that's a kind of debasement process, which means the houses inflated in price to keep boomers happy, and also so that governments could cleave the capital gains tax off it. Mm-hmm. So all these pieces have been built to essentially keep the baby boomers happy so that they get the votes. And we're now at the end of that process, because they're dying and retiring. And if we look around, I mean, as I kind of say in the book, the good news is I find the baby boomer life horrifying and terrifying at the same time. I don't want, you know, a suburban house and a factory job and just kind of do that for 30 years and get a gold watch. Just seems like a profligate waste of a human life. And there's that kind of change that I think at younger generations, particularly millennials. So the in-between generation, when you're talking about Gen X, has a different attitude to it as well, as they kind of came of age in this sort of winter of discontent, you know, late 70s years. So there's a personality difference there. The millennials lean towards things like teamwork and peer-to-peer and that kind of sharing rather than a kind of Sex Pistols rebel archetype with Gen X and just the general kind of heterosexual male capitalist competition, whoever dies with the most toys wins attitude of the boomers. So we're actually, in many respects, it's good news. If we actually just look at the data and go, well, yeah, everything that we're being promised is a lie, but the good news is we don't actually want it if we stop and think about it.
Yeah, you're right. We don't want it. I mean, I certainly didn't. And instead, I made some radical choices and took off for the West Coast without a job. But there are a lot of changes coming. Obviously, we have this movement of the baby boomers into retirement age and automation coming right on the heels of that to fill the gap and really screw the millennials. And that automation piece of the puzzle is never going to go away. It's only going to get more and more refined. So that's tough. But there's even more. You mentioned in the book, Catherine Austin Fitz refers to some of these changes as a once in a civilization event, and people might recognize this and see huge amounts of wealth accumulating in places. But how can we as individuals get a seat at the table? How can we use any of this knowledge to our benefit?
Don't be afraid to look at it is the first one. Like it is stark, as we were kind of discussing before we hit record. There's some fairly good, like my assessment of housing as an investment in the U.S. over the last 60 years isn't like an opinion. the data are there to support it. And people react emotionally to this idea. There's some kind of, and it's largely thanks to a few decades of millions and millions in advertising associating mortgage debt with some sort of threshold of adulthood where you're not a real adult until you own a house, even though you don't, because you own a mortgage. And even once you pay that off, if you don't pay your property taxes, you don't get to keep your house anyway. So if you look at these pieces and just be unemotionally and go, right, there is no other, the fake life will never work. The life you see in TV advertising will never work. So what else can we do? And there are a number of things. I mean, from an economic basis, the obvious ones are to get out of debt fast or stay out of debt. And I know people think that's an easier said than done thing, and it is, but you can – I have people who've replied saying that's easier said than done. And I'm like, well, where do you live? And I'm like, well, I live in this big house, and it's just me and my kid, and there's two of us in this four-bedroom house. And I'm like, well
– ding, ding, ding.
Sorry. we need to look at what housing means over – and this is kind of where – not that it ties in with Starships, but there's something Starships about the realization that it was really an experiment, a post-war experiment that one family could keep three houses solvent at once, grandparents, parents, and you. That's never happened before, never. Since we started building structures, we lived in multi-generational houses. We lived with friends. It never used to be called flat sharing. It was something like taking rooms and all this. But it's because the economics just didn't match. No one saw it as an investment. And even today, the most successful economy in Europe, Germany, is a majority renting population. So that's the first one. You actually have to look and decide which things are in your head that you want from your life actually belong to you and which ones belong to the sort of TV advertising that you've picked up over the 30 or so years you've been on Earth.
Yeah.
That's one that costs nothing. You can do that yourself. Doesn't really matter how much debt you have. But if you're kind of coming up to a college age, there are kind of options. Like if you got rich parents and they're going to pay for it, go to an Ivy League school. There's no sort of net difference in earnings from an education at an Ivy League school, but you get to network with various skull and bones type and get yourself a nice Washington job or so. Like that they're there. The power of expensive education is in the analog networks that you can be part of. If not, get the cheapest online McDegree you can possibly find. Because again, a couple of years out, no one's going to care that you went to Hollywood Upstairs Medical College or or something else. So there are ways that you can kind of radically carve the debt out. As for opportunities, the once-in-a-civilization event that Catherine Austin Fitz was referring to is the securitization of, or the equitization of the entire planet. So if you look at stock markets around the world, this is a number straight out of her Solari report. But if you look at stock markets around the world, in the last 30 years, they've gone from something like 9 trillion to 22. I think it's closer to 30 now. And it's on its way to 70. So this is the digital and mobile technology and infrastructure has allowed that opportunity to present itself.
Mm-hmm.
That means businesses in China and Malawi and wherever are going to be available for you as an investor to invest in via a mobile device. And coming along with this, I mean, the fintech is kind of a dirty word at the moment, because to be fair, most of it is kind of fraudulent and lying. But there's a huge amount of growth in ethical and new ways of investing that present opportunities. Again, I can give names, but everyone's situation is different, and it's a landscape you need to be aware of rather than there's a specific company. That's more of a gold rush rather than a sort of change. And mm-hmm. that also presents you with the largest base of consumers ever. Again, it's another Catherine number, but mobile handset, a smartphone in particular, ownership is over the 2 billion mark, which means it's the biggest addressable consumer market in the history of mankind.
Huh.
There's never been anything like it. And if you're a podcaster, for instance, Greg, you have access to a potential market that no one in human history has ever had access to.
Mm.
So these are the opportunities that come along with the fundamental and profoundly transformative, like economic, technological and demographic changes that we're sort of midway through.
Yeah, man, I am lucky to have stumbled my way into the positive aspects of a lot of this stuff. But you talk about the fact that both in magical practice and in life, we don't get it right because oftentimes we don't identify our targets correctly. Success magic is great, of course, but you know, what is success really? People say they want money so they can have the most freedom, but what is most likely meant is optionality. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is one of Nassim Taleb's words, but I'll kind of back it up. He talks about it when he talks about what's known as the teleological fallacy. The teleological fallacy is believing that you think you know the best way to get something done that's in the future, and also that you believe that everyone else kind of knows that as well. And if you look at anything, any kind of project or experience in any human's life, that is just fundamentally not correct. There is something about how humans are built that makes us succumb to the teleological fantasy. And everyone does it. So you just have to be aware that fallacy is in play or not. And the best way to be aware and the best way to manage the impact of a teleological fallacy is with what he considers optionality. Now, optionality is basically, and I'll give you Taleb's definition and then I'll kind of explain what that means. You're kind of in an antifragile state if you gain from disorder. So if you gain from an unanticipated event rather than negatively impact or no impact. Optionality is an example of that. So the best example is I believe it's called fuck you money. So you don't actually necessarily need to spend that, but you get fired. That's a negative event, but like not in this case, because you then have the time to do the other thing that you want. Like I'm going to write a book. I'm going to cut an album or what have you, or find another job. So optionality is kind of rather than aiming for the end goal, which is I want a house in the Hamptons or whatever it happens to be. Optionality is to kind of phase it step by step because of the teleological fantasy and maintain that ability to gain from what would have otherwise been considered a negative impact. And you do that a few times and you kind of start to build your way of thinking so that you become phased with each kind of step towards whatever your particular goal is. The sort of probabilities for the step after that change. So if you're kind of putting your intention in whatever way, either just non-magically or magically towards the end goal, you're not really maximizing the sort of probability enhancement opportunities on the way, which means you're actually less likely that you can just do the maths on it. Like if you remember doing statistics and if you go 1 in 2 times 1 in 3 times 1 in 2, you get a very tiny fraction at the end of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you do a 1 in 2 and via magic or just general intentionality, you can get that to a 55-45 odds or 60-40 odds, then you're winning, and you get to the next one, and that's another one and two. By the way, you don't have to calculate these numbers beforehand. That's some kind of lunacy. But if you think about it that way, then you're basically only dealing with moving a higher probability a bit higher rather than the sort of one in 164 option of getting what you think you want, which is going to be wrong anyway at the other side of it. Now, magicians aren't very good at this because humans aren't very good at it. But in magic's case in particular, Western magic draws so much from the sort of Greco-Roman shape of how magic works and how spells are constructed and so on. And the Greeks were amazing at trigonometry and geometry, and they were shit at basic maths. So the Greeks never invented the notion of probability. We really didn't get that until about the 17th century. There were sort of inklings of it beforehand, but it's actually a very new discipline because it's not a way, either evolutionary or otherwise. It's not a way humans are kind of built to think. So it's a muscle or it's a skill that you need to kind of learn by doing. And as it turns out, and this is kind of one of the things we talk about in the book, the universe is probabilistic. So it says something potentially quite important that we should potentially have a probabilistic understanding ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that is one of the revelations I had with this book, because when it comes to actually trying to get into magic or magical targeting, this applies greatly because it seems like we should aim for smaller factors to success rather than just writing some sigil looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, right?
Yeah. And that emerged out of sort of years of getting sigils wrong before I got them right. But basically, yes, it is the short answer. So there's a kind of complete way of, if you've never done this before, running through sigils and how you create them and their activation in the book. And the particular method that I've been espousing for a few years matches, you're kind of forced to, and this is kind of like hiding the vegetables in the kids' food, you're kind of forced to think probabilistically just by constructing and activating sigils in the way that is described in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And you did touch on this, but it is one of the great things about your writing and how you approach the mechanisms of magic is you take data from consciousness studies, near-death experiences, clues from the quantum world, and you take this knowledge and see how it can be used to fine-tune the magic, you know, to get to what works and remove what doesn't. And that's kind of the thing I really love. It kind of, in a way, it normalizes magic, you know.
You take that back.
in a good way, you know, in the best of ways for someone like me, because when I'm looking at it and it just seems like a lot of drama and theatrics to some degree, you know, you basically look at science and you say, no, look, there is something here. And I like those indications.
Well, that's chaos magic to a T. It's very opportunistic. It looks for the things that works. It doesn't promise you some sort of grand vision of how the universe works. It doesn't promise you a metaphysic that you might get with sort of whatever the Golden Dawn systems are today or theosophy or what have you. It doesn't promise you a vision or an explanation of the world. You have to build that yourself, because the reality is if you don't build it yourself, you're running off someone else's. But yes, I find it interesting. We basically have some very good data over the last 120 years that all these things that seem like they're quite important to magic have some reality to them. So consciousness survives death. There is some form of after-death state of humans that we can be in contact with. And as we know from an improved understanding of the ufological phenomenon, that little green men is an insufficient answer, so that we not only have spirits, we have spirits that, or a spirit world that is a spectrum that involves non-physical all the way to sort of full physical interaction. And you find in magic a way of not just kind of modeling that, but engaging with it with a few safety blankets around. And we also have this kind of improved understanding of things that the mind or consciousness can actually do. So you have telepathy and you have clairvoyance and you have this ability to alter, but not by much, to sort of slightly alter probabilities. And that's the kind of the other key to it. So we have Dr. Dean Radin's famous research at Burning Man with a random number generator. and people would sort of focus on it, just like, you know, and this is Burning Man, so these aren't sort of sober, normal people. Right. They're off their face and they can still do it. And that you can get measurable changes in a kind of random number generator that show that this sort of group consciousness effect can impact the material world. So you pull all these together and you go, right, so that's magic. That's what it is. And these are data that support something that, I mean, I've always known, but I think to get people who are kind of on the magic fence, off the magic fence, it kind of helps to go, all right, so this book isn't going to have too much about ascended masters and dolphins, and it's actually run through information that I can go, that doesn't sound right. Is that right? And then you can look it up and go, holy shit, that's right.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I love it. And I don't see it as often as I feel like I should in some of the books that I read. But let's talk about the life after death thing a little bit, because I personally have had an aversion to anything ghost related because of the religious implications. So I never dug too much into things like the skull experiments, for example, which now seems pretty amazing as one of the clues into how reality really works. Can you talk to us a little bit about that as the smoking gun that consciousness does survive human death?
Well, I have different guns that smoke, but the skull experiments are frankly astounding. The Society for Psychical Research was set up in London 120 years ago. I went to its birthday recently. I don't think that's right. It's more than that. Anyway, this group emerged in that very high Victorian confident way. They could see electric lighting and we had all these new things like geology and what have you and the radio. And so people were kind of like, okay, so these things exist. And it was in that interesting sort of intertidal zone between the end of a sort of not really examined Anglicanism and the rise of science. And scientists were off, you know, toddling off with their materialism. And then everyone else is like, well, that's not right either, but we have all these things. And it was kind of like, can we use these scientific processes to find out something about the afterlife? Or, you know, divinity or so on. This is one of those extremely confident and, in retrospect, hilarious projects. It still exists, and they're actually quite diligent. You would think that they would err on the side of, oh, yeah, that's definitely a ghost, or that was definitely telepathy. But the reality is most of their research is extremely boring because they will throw out I'm potentially more credulous than them. They'll throw out stuff that I think is almost open and shut. There is one that is the most incredible experiment in their more than 100-year history, which is the skull experiments, which is named for a town in the east of England. And a group of SPR members spent about a year doing, you know, it's a sort of classic Victorian seance model. Mm-hmm. Down in the basement, they had a table and there was no light, and they painted that out. And they started to get kind of channeled messages and like mild poltergeist effects. And they would meet for at least once a week for a year. And after a year or so, and on the spirits on the other side, they named the spirit team because they said, oh, we've been looking for a group that we can kind of say, like, give the definitive proof to. And this is what the spirit team said. And then after a year, the most astounding things happened. And so that they had apported objects that included newspapers from the 1940s, which are impossible to fake because they were using an ink replacement because of the war. Which you can't get anymore. Like it's not used as an ink. And so that arrived from nowhere. And they had sealed, like factory sealed canisters of Kodak film that they would unroll. And they had all these, written messages and sort of formulae and all this kind of stuff on, and just the most astounding sequence of things that cannot work in anything other than a spirit model. For people, if people are interested in this, you'll find a couple of like full-length skull documentaries on YouTube, skull experiment documentaries, and they're certainly worth your time. They're a few years old now, so if you kind of remember what Discovery Channel was like circa 2003, that's what you're in for. But the information behind it is very worth your time. And so if you kind of could hear all these data points and you could hear the NDE research, you do start to build a model that goes, okay, I can kind of logic my way to the realization of the reality of a spirit world. That's fine for most people. For magicians, there's something very different in, you know, or potentially broken, whatever, in our heads that makes you want to play with that a bit.
Yeah.
And Chaos Protocols is definitely for that sort of person.
Yeah, I like that section. It is pretty convincing for the kind of the areas I didn't want to look at previously just because of my religious upbringing and wanting to throw out everything that has to do with that. But
well, I don't land on a very specific model. I don't know what happens. You know, I don't know what they are.
Right.
So, like, yeah, I don't want to give people the idea that they'll get to the end of it and it'll be something about a tunnel and Jesus.
Right, of course. That is an important thing to point out. It's not like that. But there is some data to suggest in some form there is a life after death, and we shouldn't ignore it. That's basically the point, I guess.
For sure.
And to tie a bit of the magic to a bit of the science in a kind of a more detailed way, what would you say the Hermetica got right when it comes to understanding consciousness's interaction with matter?
So if you look, the trouble with the Hermetic texts, if you kind of talk about them all at one, is that a lot of them are goo, basically. And there are a lot of them, mm-hmm. but there is what we've kind of come to consider a sort of Hermetic worldview. Turns out to be quite, and the other risk is the last 100 years have had a bunch of kind of spiritual people who use science to kind of prove a worldview.
True.
And in both cases, we're kind of like fingers pointing at the moon here, because science is a description rather than an explanation. So they're both pointing at the same thing with different words. But the sort of kind of broad Hermetic view is one of an animate universe. So it's largely consciousness run. They use different words and a few other things run with them. But crucially, man co-creates reality, which is in some sense sort of unfinished by the act of sort of observation and learning. And that is a sort of devotion to God to kind of do that. So you have this idea of we being a tiny reflection of the sort of cosmic mind as an individual mind. And in the act of observing reality, we in some sense complete creation. Now that looks very similar to the double slit experiments of the sort of mid 20th century quantum theorists, for instance. There are other pieces that I find kind of interesting, which I learned recently, like subsequent to the publishing of the book. So there's that famous microcosm, macrocosm thing, so that each human is a perfect encapsulation of the divine. Now, if you look at how NPCs are built in a game environment, in a digital environment, they have to have a map of the entire world in their heads to function correctly. So the entire universe is in their head, just so like in the head of every little NPC character, so that they can operate within the world of the game.
Yeah,
I think that's really interesting, because if one did have to build an entire universe, which we now do, it turns out that you have to basically work to Hermetic models to get the whole thing to work.
Yeah, it's amazing, man. So to wade us into some of the magic stuff in relation to our economic situation, you dedicate a chapter to what you call true initiation or becoming invincible. And its importance is summed up pretty well with this quote: "There is no greater defense against the grim, uncompromising wasteland of the late capitalist world than the unshakable awareness that it will end and you will not." And that's beautiful, man. Talk to us about the importance of becoming invincible and just how the hell we actually do that.
Sure. Well, it's a magic book. I mean, it's published by Llewellyn, and they do a lot of metaphysical kind of 101 books, which I wasn't sure I wanted to write. And mine's kind of a Heston Blumenthal deconstructed one of these things. One of the things that is sort of fraught with challenge in the Western magical tradition is initiation and authenticity, because we haven't had initiatory traditions for 1,500 years. So since the mystery schools ended, there is no secret kind of group running down through that. So initiation has become fairly politicized in the last 130 years, where when the Golden Dawn built their system, they kind of modeled it on Freemasonry and pretended they had all these secret documents, which is sort of very a Rosicrucian thing to do. The OTO, which is German when Crowley joined it, everyone's pretending they're a lot older than they are, and they're not, right? Mm-hmm. So we have kind of malformed discussions in the magical world about initiation. Now, in the meantime, in the rest of the world, there is initiation. Initiation is a kind of triggering event that makes you realize reality is not advertised at all. And it can be, in the book, I kind of say, you can skip this chapter if Discovery Channel's done a ghost show in your house, or if you've been abducted by aliens. Like, it needs to be an extreme event after which there's no getting the toothpaste back into the tube. Like, you cannot return to an official reality because it's incomplete. Now,
right.
Initiation truly done, if you look at, say, New Guinean Highlanders, or if you look at people being initiated as Eurasian shaman, or kind of similar roles in the Amazon, or even sort of the sort of classic First Nations vision quest kind of ideas, you have to have an inciting incident that triggers this, that triggers this engagement with the universe in a way that is extremely profound, that is, you can kind of BCAD your life around it. So becoming invincible is what I call that, because once you've had that experience, once you know, and I emphasize, it doesn't even need to be pleasant. I mean, I hope it is, but it doesn't need to be.
Right.
Once you know that it's not as advertised, you are invincible. Like, if your boss has had a bad day and she's just being a cow to you, all these things become smaller. They become smaller because they're not, it's not real, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all. This isn't actually reality. And more importantly, you're invincible. Like, death can't end you. That's kind of the prize that's about a third of the way through anyone's magical journey, that unshakable realization. And once you get it, the rest is gravy. And unfortunately, the other two thirds, when it comes to sort of more traditional magical orders, they've kind of populated the remaining two thirds with different aprons and different titles and colors and crossing the abyss and all this stuff, which is gilding the lily.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a before and after. Once you know that you are invincible, and I mean that in the sense that please don't jump off a roof. I mean, when death comes for you, you don't end. That really puts everything else in a perspective that you can never unperspective, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah.
Let's just invent words. So that's kind of that's kind of what becoming invincible means.
Right. And that is an important part in the book. And you can't obviously induce a typical alien abduction scenario or a ghost in your house for Discovery Channel to cover, but psychedelics, they really are invincibility in the palm of your hand. Of course, you have to use them the right way.
Yeah, you have to do them right. So it's a Terence McKenna thing, but he sort of said a shaman without psychedelics is like a pilot without a stunt plane. Like, you're not doing it correctly.
Yeah.
And we do have this opportunity, and it's part of the sort of collapse of our current sort of, you know, totalitarian superstructure piece by piece. It doesn't all come down at once. It's like cake in a rain. Is that there are ways that you can legally do this now. And the other pushback I get is it's too expensive to go to the Amazon or what have you to do it right. It's an opportunity cost error. Like, it'll cost you a few grand, no question, but you're not going to, hopefully you're not going to want your TV when you come back.
Like, How do you put a price on invincibility?
Put the book down. Like, I'm not saying that's the only way to do it. And in fact, there are states in the US where you'll be able to find, you know, ethical magical groups or witches or so on. And there are legally available molecules, and you combine that in a ritual space and it might work. But this is what we have used for 30,000 years to become invincible. So it was a difficult part to write in that chapter, because obviously it's a book published by a proper publisher in the US. So I can't be like, get some mushrooms, however you get them. Here's a prayer. Have a sitter. Go and do this, because they can't have that book. And I mean, technically we can't say it here either.
Technically we can't, but I would. I mean, from my experience, I would say, don't even let legalities get in the way of your immortality.
No, well, yeah, I didn't. And I kind of had to put it in the book, which is a big deal. I know people, there's a tendency at the moment to overemphasize ayahuasca. It's kind of.
Yes, trendy.
Yeah, it's like olive oil was in the late 90s or something. everyone's writing books about how they went to Tuscany and learned how to press olive oil. And it's the same thing with ayahuasca now. I'm not sure if I sent it to you, but the fantastic Onion article, ayahuasca shaman dreading upcoming week of teaching more tech CEOs about spirituality or something. And that's basically where we're at.
Right.
So like I don't want it to fall into that trap, because there are other molecules and there are other routes and there are other traditions that will take you on that journey without you having to, like, that is part of their tradition, will do that. And then you're not going to wake up and suddenly you're in, I didn't sign up for this religion there, you know,
right.
What have you. And there are a number of them around the world. There are a number of places where you can do that, because it is medicine. So it's viewed in a medicinal way. And, as part of their role, that you can be welcomed in and have these experiences in the correct space that, will do it. And if anything, like, I'm glad you picked up on it, because the magical community likes to talk about the ritual component, which is the other half of the chapter. But I do actually open it with, there's no, like, the best way to do it is this. And I can't say otherwise. It would be dishonest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, because at the time when I was first getting into psychedelics, I had a friend who had the same kind of thing. He was going down a more meditative consciousness, astral projection type realm. And we were both coming to similar conclusions in our exploration. But I was like, man, for me, I just have to dive right into the deep end of the pool. It's nice that you can wade in nice and slow and methodically. But for me, it doesn't work. And my inciting event was salvia. I know I'm in the minority, but you definitely didn't have to go far to get salvia when I did it. It was available actually in head shops.
Yeah. Is it still?
I don't know if it still is or not.
Yeah, I haven't had it for years, but I think it's available here.
Yeah, not pleasant, but yeah. I'd recommend it.
But it doesn't need to be pleasant. That's the thing.
Exactly.
Again, if you're going to do something that lasts longer than salvia, you'd want it to be pleasant. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and to get to that other side, you also do dedicate some time to our ancestors and the dead. I know we've talked a bit about ancestors before. I'm sitting just 5 feet from my own personal ancestor altar right now.
Oh, well done.
Yes, finally. But in this economic context, how can communing with the dead be helpful?
Ooh, depends on the dead. You can go full necromancy and, I don't know, summon up JP Morgan from wherever he is down there.
Wow.
But, well, when, I mean, I haven't, and I wouldn't recommend that, but technically you can, you know.
I still got the training wheels on, man.
The ancestor work it's kind of like non-specific luck magic. If you think, even for people who've been adopted or had family trauma early on, you can skip people. I kind of go into the Romans in particular would adopt people just so that they would have someone to perform ancestor rites once they died. Same thing that kind of happens with China and Japan now in some places. Because if you've had a falling out with your son or your daughter's died or what have you, like this is part of the process. So I just want to kind of put that out there, because I feedback wise, if people are adopted or they've, you know, had family trauma and so on, that's all the thing. You can skip generations. You can also, and this was like the worst magic in Egypt, but you can erase ancestors. You can actually get, I deny you this food. I deny you this water. If you're in that, that happened to Hatshepsut, the sort of female pharaoh. They kept rubbing, they erased her names after her death. And that's very powerful magic in Egypt.
They say that about Akhenaten too.
Yeah, exactly. Because they're alive. I mean, the Egyptians have that kind of wonderful, crazy animist cosmology. So you're doing damage. You are actually destroying that thing. That's sort of how it works.
Damn.
I'm not saying do that with your ancestor altar on day one. What I am saying is that if you are alive today in 2016, you have a bloodline, you have a chain of people going back to the first human. There is no other way that you're here. Now, that's a long chain of hardship and you know, challenges that have been overcome and so on. So there's a sort of a wellspring of perspective available from it. But from a magical perspective, given that this was archaeologically, it appears that this was our first spirituality, the remembrance of our dead families. Mm-hmm. We have kind of broken from that, admittedly only recently in the West. Like if you have a Catholic sort of background and you go back about 80, 90 years, there's ghosts everywhere and little pictures of uncle whoever and whatever on the wall, and people saying mass for the departed and all this kind of stuff. That is ancestor veneration. It's just, it doesn't look like the sort of marvelous spirit houses that you get in Southeast Asia. So we've kind of fallen away from that. And you find that it's tremendously transformative in over the long term in bringing this back, but you also just get luckier. It's something about the reconnection with your family and the spirit world that I kind of put it in and out of the book because I didn't want to push anything that resembled like, here's what I believe on mm-hmm. people because I don't, it's not what I do. But this one had to stay in because it technically falls under luck magic in a book like this. Please don't sort of reconnect with your ancestors and buy a lottery ticket. You can't use it to get lucky at something, but yeah. You'll get better traffic. You'll have those kind of benign coincidences that make the universe taste better. And I kind of looked when I was compiling the book, I'm like, right, so I need stuff about this and stuff about that and stuff about this. And I'm obviously going to need to talk about, after I've talked about probability, I'm going to need to talk about luck magic. And there are spells in the back for that. But I spoke to the editor about it. I'm like, if I'm honest, this has been the thing that's kind of improved my background, quote unquote, luck, amongst other things, more than anything else. So, yeah, I'm very happy it's in there.
It's interesting. And outside of ancestors, you also do get very detailed about the actual rituals and which entities can be helpful in success magic. Talk to us about some of those entities that come to mind that aren't ancestors.
Well, I mean, staying in the same chapter, there are a number of different ways of kind of either connecting or improving your relationship with the spirit world. So we have sort of Hermanibus invocations, and Hermanibus, speaking of that kind of Greco-Roman world, is one of my favorite things to come out of it. It's a combination, as you can kind of tell from the name, of the Greek Hermes and the Egyptian Anubis. So Hermes is the kind of messenger of the gods role. He is also called Hermes Chthonios. So he's a psychopomp in the sense that he can, in some forms, take people who have died to the afterlife. So he's one of those kind of crossing between life and death figures. It's always been like the actual word Hermes probably came from the name for a little pile of stones that was used as a border marker in archaic Greece. So it's about that border between this world and the next. Mm. And Anubis is, of course, the jackal-headed god of, well, we say god of mummification. It's a woeful oversimplification. Crowley describes him quite well in his Book of Thoth about the moon card because he has Anubis there. Anubis has a few Egyptian and then later Greek titles to talk, like called way opener or opener of the way. So when in the Greco-Roman world, they're very interested in kind of plugging their gods together like Lego. And if things matched other things, they kind of smushed them together. And so you have this dizzying kind of polyglot cosmology.
Kind of chaos magic in a way.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And my favorite one is Hermanibus, because it's a combination of the, like, I have a quite good thing going with Hermes anyway. For some reason, the god of thieves favors Australians. No idea why. And so I kind of pulled some of the, and modified some of the rituals from the Greek magical papyri, or at least invocations, because Hermanibus has worked quite well. And what's interesting about that, and is, well, I think it's interesting, is the persistence of dog-headed gods into early Europe, and in fact into quite late Europe. So you have some of the more famous saints. Even Saint Christopher was dog-headed, and right up until the sort of end of the medieval age, and in northern Europe a bit later, the outside of some towns would have dog-headed Saint Christophers, because obviously he's the guardian of travelers and so on. So even sort of 2,000 years later, well, less than 1,200 years later, this form is still with us right there on the border again with wayfarers. So there's kind of there's a bit of an experiment, but there's a way of sort of deepening or pulling back into the modern world some of that, Western magical current, which we didn't really realize was there the whole time. So that one I think is quite good. There's also one of my favorite saints, St. Nicholas of Tolentino, and you'll find him in there as well. But in terms of, it can get risky looking for You're kind of barking up the wrong tree or going down the wrong track. I shouldn't use the barking thing after all that dog talk. If you are trying to find the spirit or God responsible for success or financial wealth, and there's a long-running joke amongst grimoire magicians about one of the spirits called Boon, which everyone, because it does say in Boon's description that these are the things he's good at. So people buy these grimoires and it's straight to Boon and their life doesn't change. And Chaos Protocols hopefully deals with some of the structure underneath that, because I'm not sure if your kind of spiritual journey should align with your interest in going on a backpacking holiday in Southeast Asia. These two things may overlap, but it gets messy when they get combined. There are spirits in there that people probably haven't considered for success and optionality reasons, and that's why I wrote the book. But there's a similar risk to using kind of science to explain religion to go looking for a quote unquote god of wealth.
Man, when we make up kind of our own personal cosmology of entities that we resonate with, obviously we can do some reading and pick out gods and beings and spirits we like. But you say things in the book like tricksters are typically found at a crossroads, so look there first. And that suggests a more kind of active approach to creating that Rolodex of entities to call on. Talk to us about the process of creating our cosmology and, you know, forging relationships with these kind of entities.
Well, sure. The trickster appears to be structural in the universe and structural in how we construct our maps of the universe. So there's George Hansen's fantastic book, The Trickster and the Paranormal. You also find across literally every kind of cultural or spiritual system a trickster role. So you find them in First Nations cultures. You obviously have Loki in the north. You have Set in Egypt. Now, the trickster for Western Europe for the last 1500 years is the devil. This is, if we look at the role of the devil, and I don't mean like the kind of frothing, Bible-thumping, flyover, CIA-funded millennial church nonsense that just is, it's not even Christianity at this point. Mm-hmm. If you look at European folk culture, the devil isn't in some kind of dualistic crazy war with God for your soul because you played D&D or masturbated. The devil kind of does annoying trickster things. So Bugs Bunny, basically, at some point, he gives cattle ringworm or something odd. Now, when you look at how this form moved into how Europeans saw the world, the devil got his power by being the oldest thing on earth. The devil was created before the earth. So the fact that the devil is intimately involved with mankind, if you are if you're an illiterate Spanish grandmother 500 years ago and you need something earthly, the person who, or the being you go to is the devil. The being you go to is the one that has been here and was set by God to kind of be the boss of this realm. Like that is not a misreading of her priest on Sunday. She's not actually being anything other than Catholic by doing it. She's being a bit risky, but she's not being a devil worshiper. We find that this, particularly in sort of from the 20th century onwards, the devil in hoodoo in the southern states particularly hybridized with some of the, probably a bit of First Nations beings, but certainly some of the gatekeeping beings that came over from West African cosmologies. So there, you know, you have famous stories of jazz musicians and so on meeting the devil at the crossroads and suddenly being very good at guitar. So Robert Johnson is one of these. He then subsequently died a few years later. Now, we look at it and we kind of need to unpick a lot of the racism flat out in that. Robert Johnson may have called this thing the devil, but this was practicing African magic, right? And we've had this whole thing that, you know, oh, it's devil worship and whatever. And I mean, you're not scared of the devil. You're scared of the skin color. Don't give me that. Which is pathetic because we have, you know, us white people have the same thing in our own folk magic and grimoire traditions. We've sanitized the trickster out because we think unpredictability equals failure. This is the thing where we're kind of built for that boomer life, even though we don't want it, we still gravitate to it because humans don't like the anxiety of unpredictability, even though that's where all success and all learning and all growth comes from.
Boom.
So if you do not have a trickster in your own personal cosmology, I'm not saying everyone go and be a devil worshiper or anything. I'm not even, my goodness. If you don't make a space in how you view the world for trickster functionality, you're kind of a bit, you have a lopsided view of the universe for a start, but also you're potentially missing, based on what we now know about probability and so on, you're potentially missing where the upside comes from, especially in 2016 and moving forward. The unpredictability. We have teenage billionaires on one side of the world and we have entire country and entire collapsed cities on the other. This is not a normal unpredictable world. This is a world that has, you know, trickster running through it. The magician then is, it kind of falls to him or her to align with that in some way. And so the book goes into tremendous detail about, well, not tremendous detail, that makes it sound boring. Mm-hmm. It goes into some detail about the justification for having a trickster component, and then it provides suggestions for how that might work in a Western magical sense to do with essentially a sort of crossroad engagement with the devil. Most of it is largely drawn, again, on Greco-Roman practice. It's actually very similar to how you would attract Hecate's blessing or interest, the sort of going to the crossroad and leaving things and never looking back and all that kind of stuff is Hecatean rather than devilish. But that form survives into, shall we say, low grimoire magic. And so the book goes into how you do that.
I know we're running a little long here, but a couple of the things I wanted to bring up, something I wanted to ask you about in terms of assessing the landscape that's coming. It comes from a comment you made on a Rune Soup podcast episode with Chris Knowles. Of course, the Rune Soup podcast is becoming a personal favorite. Everyone should check it out. But in that episode, you guys talk about the elite and the shadow state and the idea we've explored that physics and science have been left with only half the puzzle because of the empowering implications of things like Tesla tech and all that kind of stuff. But there's very little left to explore at this point without unlocking some of those doors. And you've identified some possible clues that they might be planning to finally let this genie out of the box, so to speak. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. Firstly, because they said they're going to. I mean, we've had about four or five different countries and organizations announce fusion and cold fusion. We also have NASA's hyperdrive, which violates their own official laws of physics, because it does, and it's going to work. And so we have these pieces. The other one that I think is interesting is the Rockefeller Trust exiting hydrocarbon 6 months before we essentially got Wall Street, or the State Department told Wall Street to crash oil to crush Putin, mm-hmm. Which didn't work. He saw it coming years out. It doesn't matter. So, but they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't sort of leave these assets if it was going to bounce back up. And all these other pieces are coming through, like Elon Musk's new battery, and everyone's talking about fusion tech and the hyperdrive. And we have people like Dr. Paul LaViolette, who are actual, you know, proper science people who've done these experiments and go, well, this works and this works. I don't know what it is. It's interesting to me that torsion works, and I've really enjoyed your Electric Universe episodes, because there is something in that spectrum of, again, we come back to like the data and the interpretation thing. So the Tesla thing was interesting enough, and we have, you know, directed energy weapons, which appears to be a version of that. So there is a kind of energy or ether physics that is toroidal that I think they've been around for about 50 years, and I think it's time that the toys are coming in now, probably because we don't need – it's tied up with, I would say, the rise of pushing us into a digital currency. The U.S. dollar has had a de facto oil backing since the end of the war, basically. Well, since we came off the gold standard, right? Mm-hmm. I think when we have this kind of global digital SDR – we don't need the oil anymore. I think that's built. And I actually think, given all the talk about all this sort of monstrous hysterical climate change stuff, like Islamophobia causes climate change, and like really dialing up the fucking moron speak on this. I think the SDR drawdowns will be based on compliance with some sort of carbon emissions, and it's sort of the way you can keep China and India down and sort of post-industrial countries like Europe and the US up.
Right.
Because it's much easier for us to kind of run to carbon laws. So we get X amount of SDRs, and from that we can create this currency. Because I know Catherine Austin Fitz was saying before she thinks it's food, and now it isn't. I think it's this. I think if you look at these kind of push through agreements and stuff that, I mean, I'm sure carbon dioxide has some sort of effect, but it's now, like they're saying, Islamophobia causes climate change, or climate change causes Islamophobia. And like, this is not science. This is more of that dialing up the moron speak.
Right.
So I think that's why. I think it's ready for the global digital currency. I think it's almost ready for its close up. And it begins with the kind of SDR in the background. So yeah, we don't need the oil. We've already used the cool weapons. I suspect we're already using the cool propulsion engines off planet. And yeah, from an oil perspective, that's not really coming back. It doesn't need its use anymore. And also we're going to go and hopefully collapse our friends and allies, or let them collapse, hopefully very soon.
Yeah, I just thought that opened up a level of clarity for me, because as soon as they take all their assets out of oil, you know, they could roll out something new for us and then penalize the rest of the world for using the very energy sources that were the elite's bread and butter for decades, kind of forcing them to move into the new stuff.
Yeah, climate change, whether it exists or not, is imperial policy. It's as simple as that. And that's why, China has a serious pollution problem, let me be clear. And they're aware of it. But they don't, neither does Russia. They're not going anywhere near this climate change crap, because it is there to say, so we built the greatest economies ever using this stuff, and now you can't have any.
And we're going to charge you to even use it.
Yeah, this is how it gets played. Like, this game isn't, this is the world that's not built for us. We need to be aware of it, not so we can change it. Let's not be so infantile as to think we can, I don't know, run to the principal's office and get this fixed. It's just not how it works. The more we understand about how this moves around, it becomes strategic intelligence for us to live our best lives.
Yeah. Amen. And I also wanted to ask you, do you see something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership relating to this in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the build out of the legal infrastructure that allows a sort of paternal imperialism giving, you know, rivers to Nestle and all this kind of stuff. Basically, this is they're at the end of their end game. Even if they manage to get it across the Western world, it's obviously not going to work in Eurasia. And I don't think it's going to work that well here. It is a fortunate potential, like, built into the universe, that the Tower of Babel never makes it to heaven. They will always try. And that's almost Gnostic in a way. But yes, this is absolutely the climate change hysteria. And it is not, like, if you read the most recent climate change articles, it's seriously stuff like it causes Islamophobia, or Islamophobia is causing it. And this is building up a narrative that goes along with the kind of supranational treaties that are essentially harvesting the real assets that are now useful. And things like fresh water is useful.
Yeah.
Oil less so. But the good news is the good news in that absolute clusterfuck is to do this, again, coming back to that opening up of new platforms and new markets, there will be opportunities for people who can see this happening to either get out in front of it or get to the side of it. If you know that that's going to be the case, I don't mean go and invest in Halliburton and that kind of stuff, because I think that eats away at your soul a bit. But these investments are going to be made, and they're going to be made with your money because it's tax money. So get out in front of it and get some of it back.
Yeah. And I'm kind of living proof of that, because I don't think GameStop, if I was going to be a store manager there forever, if I was going to be scared into the traditional path, I don't think GameStop's going to be there in 5, 6, 7 years. But that's a whole nother thing. To throw one more log on that fire, you off the air, you've told me about some corporation that doesn't have a website that the Rockefellers are invested in, that it's, I think they're a cold fusion company.
They're when we say alternative energy, we usually mean sort of, you know, permaculture wind farms. It's called Tri Alpha, doesn't have a website. It's based in California.
Interesting name.
Well, this is why I mention it. So it's got the tri in the beginning of it, and the alpha is interesting. It's the, you know, new beginning for this. It doesn't have a website, has some of the most famous sort of, you know, energy physicists or theoretical ones attached to it, has Rockefeller Trust funding, entirely opaque, no idea what they're doing. And this is happening at the same time as we're hearing the Germans and the Japanese and MIT and everyone saying we've got cold fusion, or we're a little bit away from it. And it's that classic ritual thing they do. Of course it's called Tri Alpha.
Yeah.
Like Tri Dash Alpha. This is their, you know, waving their dick just in the corner. Hello.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I that's all I have for that. But the idea that this stuff can't move in the dark is moronic. It can. And that's an example. You'll find the Wikipedia page, I believe, but how many of them are there that don't have Wikipedia pages?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that just so fascinating. I'm glad we could touch on it, but that really does about do it for us. I know we're close to the finish line, but I do love this book. It validates some of the choices I've made in the past 10 years, and it helps me with where to go from here, because the high optionality life that I've been lucky to achieve with THC sort of scares me back into traditional patterns, because it's hard to lose what you don't have. But when you do have something, risk starts to seem scarier. Maybe it's been too long since I did mushrooms or something, you know?
Well, I also, we don't know. So your focus was on, you know, making this a success. And once you're there, that was the dream, right? Like,
yeah.
I want this to be, I want to make this a success. So you didn't actually necessarily dream what the next step was. You may have daydreamed in that kind of absurd, like, I'm on a boat sense. But no one ever thinks about what happens, because it will happen if people kind of sort of absorb some of the ideas in the book. So you haven't thought about what the Greg version of the next step is. So you have fallen into, oh, I guess I get a house now, and I guess
yeah,
I guess I do that. And it's just the programming. So think about what you actually want.
Mm. Well said, man. And, you know, of course, I got to let you go sometime. My ancestral offerings aren't going to change out themselves, but you are the man. And, you know, part of my job is recommending books, but this goes beyond that. I would say that if you're feeling stuck or trapped or looking for the guidance to change it up, I have found no better guide, man. Anything else you want to mention before we go? Obviously, Twitter is your main hang, @Gordon_White, and runesoup.com is your blog. Is there anything else to say?
Yeah, those are the places. There's a RuneSoup Facebook page as well, which if people don't really do the Twitter thing, they can find me there.
Boom. Dude. All right. I'm sad that it's over, but this was great. Until next time, take care of yourself. All right, my man.
You as well.
Cool. All right, people. How'd you like that? I loved it. Gordon's always good to have, but The Chaos Protocols is such a great book. If you're lacking for a roadmap in these troubled times, it's definitely the book to get. It's funny and an informative read. You can't go wrong. And I guess today I did pat myself on the back a little too much, and I am sorry if that got annoying, but it's just a good feeling to have a book like this back up some of my wild decision making, and it's a relief to now have an easy thing to hand someone when they don't understand what I do for a living or why it's a smart idea. It's the next Christmas present for half my extended family. Let's just make it easy, guys. And Gordon lays out some of the magic that he's had good results with, and who couldn't use that reference on their shelf, you know? But when you think of magic as less mysterious and more of a flowery word for the mechanisms in which consciousness interacts with the material world, people who find it evil or wrong start to sound pretty goofy, because it's as natural as hearing or speech in a way. It's just a tool of interaction with the world and what's beyond it. And in times like these, it would behoove anyone to explore and fine-tune all the tools they have. And the Plus show is largely about that. And this is a great Plus show to have. We got deeper into the details of Gordon's magical recommendations, how to find the right crossroads at which to forge your relationship with the trickster of your choice, and a lot of other deep level stuff. In fact, when we talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and some of the major events going on geopolitically as indicators that the elite are, as Gordon called it, at the end of their endgame, that really should have been in the Plus show, but I couldn't do that. I really wanted to get it out there because I just think he's got a better approach to analyzing the playbook than just saying, oh, disclosure is coming, out of guessing or blind optimism. He's looking at something like the TPP and the carbon tax schemes and giving you reasons why this is happening and where it may be going. Don't you wish more guests and social commentators were just half as thoughtful? But being bold and becoming invincible, another good section. That sometimes scary rite of passage that really should be more celebrated than some arbitrary bar mitzvah or confirmation or baptism. I mean, these are all empty, hollowed out versions of an experience that I do think we all need to have, and very few are actually out there recommending. And I never thought of my early psychedelic breakthroughs as the acclimation of armor on the path to invincibility, but really they were. And I'm lucky also to have an encouraging partner. My special lady, Teresa, has talked me into several things I initially said no to for one reason or another, like the Don Peyote bus tour. I was going to pass until she grilled me on what a random opportunity it was. And of course it was great, but I just tend to say, nah, I'm all right, a little more than I probably should. And how is the magic supposed to work with that attitude? You wish and enchant for interesting opportunities, and when they come up, you gotta say yes. I mean, have you seen Yes Man with Jim Carrey? Great, great movie that really drives that point home. But do what you can to say yes to your own opportunities. The hard part is having them come your way. All you gotta do is go with it. And also encourage others you care about to dive into their opportunities. There is no glory in the cubicle, people. None. But even I fail to take my own advice sometimes. There's this festival here in California called Lightning in a Bottle. It's a pretty big thing. And shockingly, they asked me to speak. And of course, I said no, because I'd rather sit in my bunker and talk into the microphone where it's safe. But I could have done that. And I looked at the roster, and my main man, Marty Leeds, he's going to be there. Probably would have been fun, but I was too afraid of bombing. So nobody's perfect. It is a process. And speaking of Marty, he just released a movie that sort of announced his acceptance of the flat earth model. Can you believe that? I'm going to have to get him on to talk about that. I'm pretty surprised, but I love the guy, so we'll have to see what's up. I told you I thought it pointed out some glaring inconsistencies with what we've been told, but anyway, great stuff. Gordon White really is the man. Do check out his Rune Soup podcast. Do pick up the book. Forging your own path in an unfamiliar economic landscape is scary, no doubt. Might as well have a guidebook to reference. But what more can I say? That is it for today. I've done what I can. Your move, elite architects of the economic endgame and sorcerers of the new system. Your fucking move.
Coward, it's your show now. So what's it gonna be? 'Cause people will tune in to hear another new conspiracy. Almost too much of, we thought this was low. It's bad, getting worse. So where'd all the good people go? They're on the higher side chats 'cause it's everybody's favorite show. Where'd all the good people go? He got Jamar's coat in white, and then there's Crow. They talk this and that on the higher side chat, testing 1, 2, now what you gonna do? Bad news, misuse, got too much to lose. Give me some truth, now whose side we on? Whatever you say, turn on the boob tube. I'm in the mood to obey, so lead me astray. By the way now, where'd all the good people go? They locked them up, it seems, for protesting Monsanto. Where'd all the good people go? They're on the THC, my favorite show. difficult to hear. Wanna light a bolt, but I fear the police. Can you hear me? Can't interrupt me from this friendly conversation. Been waiting all week for THC. With the car wood, there's no hesitation. Exposing the truth, getting to the elite. Scams, schemes, conspiracies, and treason. It's an excellent show. What I need to know is, where'd all the good people go? Been only getting hate and fear from all the other hoes. Where'd all the good people go? Guess that makes THC my favorite show. They talk this and that on the highest side chat. Testing 1, 2, now what you gonna do? Bad news, misuse, got, give me some truth. You got too much to lose. Whose side are we on today? Anyway, okay, whatever you say. Wrong and resolute, but in the mood to obey. Station to station, desensitizing the nation. Going gone.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the first hour of the Higher Side Chats podcast with me, Greg Carlwood. If you don't know, there is a second hour to all the episodes we do around here. Generally, we're able to get a lot deeper into the topics and ideas that a guest is about, so if you enjoyed what you've heard from THC for free, consider signing up at thehighersidechatsplus.com to get the second hour of the 5 shows I put together each month. I never really wanted to be a paid subscriber podcast, but I really hate the idea of spending airtime promoting some product that's completely unrelated and telling you the best way to support the show is to buy an audiobook or new underwear by mail or something crazy like that. So instead, if you like the show, double your time with it for $5 a month and let's cut out all the other shit. It's half the price of a movie ticket and you get at least an extra 5 hours of show a month. Collectively, it keeps us stable and it frees me from wasting your time with anything but the show you came to listen to. It's really the only way for an independent, one-man show to make it, and I do what I can so that it's worth your while. Since we started this, I've always tried to use the subscriptions to improve the podcast and make signups more advantageous. It started with just a second hour for the main show, but now we've got a nice forum going where people can get deeper in conversation about the episodes with other listeners, submit a candidate in the guest request thread, or share their own personal projects to get out of the soul-crushing 9-to-5 cog-in-the-wheel life on the entrepreneurs thread. The forum and the plus comments are always the first places I try to go for listener engagement, but it does get harder as the show gets more popular. Because of that, there's also a direct messaging feature that you can use to reach me through the plus site also. But beyond the forum, if you like any of the music I've used for THC, most of it I've hired artists to make, and I provide it all as free downloads to Plus members too. So if you like a particular song you've heard close the show out recently, come get the MP3. I should also mention that if you don't like the idea of paying $5 recurring every month, I get that. You can buy 3 months, 6 months, or a year up front and just be done with it. I have plenty of listeners who send checks and money orders to the P.O. Box too. I try to make it as easy for people as I can, and you can read more about it on the sign-up page. Also, be sure to check out the FAQ help page on the Plus site. If you have any questions or concerns about how to listen to a password-protected show on your devices, I've highlighted a lot of great solutions, and one of those would be the iPhone app that just recently hit the Apple App Store. A super kind and talented listener made it for us, and you can use it to stream or download either the free or the Plus show. If you're on Android, I'd use Pocket Casts or Podcast Addict and subscribe to the feed manually that way. I also try to throw in occasional bonus shows or Q&A shows, and I've got a few other weird ideas I might get to try out soon, but I give you all I can for $5, and I hope you'll at least give it a shot if you've listened to a few free shows and you find them unique or valuable. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I'm just one of them. But if you have any questions, concerns, or comments about any of this, please get in touch with us at thehighersidechatsteam@gmail.com. I also wanted to plug the Higher Side newsletter I'm going to be putting out, totally free for anyone who wants to sign up at the main internet website for the show, thehighersidechats.com. You can also get on that email list through the Higher Side Chats Facebook page. There's a button there as well. But the reason I'm doing this is because I get tons and tons of emails after a show goes up asking me about how I feel about a particular guest or topic, and the wrap-up isn't always the best place to do that, especially if I have anything negative to say. Sometimes the dust needs to settle, sometimes I need to hear feedback from you guys first. There are a lot of factors, but I usually have something to communicate to you, and I just don't get to do it. So on the first of the month, I plan to send out a little newsletter with my thoughts about the 5 shows the previous month, and talk to you about anything else that's on my mind or that's going on. And what's probably most enticing is that I'm going to give you some insight into at least one guest I have coming up in the month, which people have been begging for some posted schedule for a long time. I personally think I'd like the surprise. But sign up for the Higher Side newsletter. It's free. It comes out on the first of the month, and I won't waste your time with any other emails. And that's it. I appreciate you listening. I try to give alternative ideas and guests a fair shake on a high-quality podcast, expose some deep-level conspiracies without the yelling, and I hope to offer some inspiration that even though the system relentlessly suggests you should follow their blueprint to mediocrity, you can do your own thing and live a much happier life despite all the negativity in the world. So go ahead and treat yourself. Isn't it about time?